Hey guys, popping in with a reminder to sign up for the GovHub newsletter. This weekly pop of politics is designed to share action items, resources, and quick links to civic engagement tools and topics directly to your inbox. Save it, share it, and sign up for a pinch of productive politics today by going to girlonthegov.com or visiting this episode's description.
Welcome back to Girl on the Gov, the podcast,
where we're shooting the shit with elected officials and candidates running for office to get to know the person beyond the politics.
Because politicians needed a rebrand.
Baby, we're back. We're back again.
My single will be releasing next week. Thank you.
We did it. I didn't know we had an Elvis impersonator in the room. But
it really did
Jesus
sound like that.
Christ. Anyways, we mentioned last week, do not have a fresh interview for you all. We are playing a repeat episode, given the fact that we are recording this in the past, a week old version of us. And yeah, we want to bring back an interview that is pertinent, always, honestly, always pertinent, but especially lately. We're adding our timely intro to this older interview because there are some things to talk about.
Totally. And this interview, just to give you guys like a little bit of a hint, is with Chris Brown from Brady United. So we're talking about gun reform. And if you guys missed it, because there has just been a crazy amount of news lately, and obviously in SCOTUS season in June, it's truly bananas. But one of the cases that they ruled on was one involving a federal bump stock ban. So these pieces you attach to a gun and it becomes a machine gun as a result. Mm-hmm. Ironically, or just maybe more surprisingly, under the Trump administration, that's how that initially went down through the ATF following the really gruesome mass shooting in Las Vegas. So what the court came to the conclusion of is that, hey, this is an overstep of the ATF's authority. If Congress wants to pass a law, that's a whole nother story. Okay. So then Schumer, knowing that the Republicans will probably block it, decided like, hey, let's do another campaign year, election year, symbolic vote situation to show who the Republicans really are. He brought, actually, ironically, though, as I say that, a bipartisan bill that has Susan Collins on it to ban these bump stocks federally or at the national level. There are states across, I think it's about 15 states, that have statewide bans on bump stocks. Some of them might be impacted by this ruling a little bit, but not all. Regardless of that, yet again, we have these Republicans blocking gun reform, which is so wild to me that, like, I get that they're playing games, and so are the Dems in an election year. It's par for the course. It's part of the whole thing. But, like, this was a popular piece of gun reform.
It always is.
It happened under the Trump administration, for God's sake. So if you're a Trumper, yeah. If anything, you should be like, look at what my president did. Like, it's
my president. My president.
Like, literally, though. So it's really crazy.
It is really crazy. They're just all cock blockers, truly. Like, a lot of Democrats are also cock blockers in the Senate.
Yeah.
But Republicans are especially. And, you know, we saw that a couple weeks ago with all of them voting no on basic right to basic contraception. All for the politics of it all. And now we're seeing it again with gun reform, which are, again, both of repro and guns are like a very agreed upon issue for the most part for a majority of Americans. Like, there is a lot of bipartisan support for definitely for contraception and a lot for gun reform. Yeah. These Republicans showing us who they are, which are literal just political pawns. They're not working for you. They're not working for us. And we're sick of it.
Sick of it. Absolutely sick of it. It's like a common sense reform, this bump stock ban. It's not banning you from owning guns or having guns or
No.
Like, it's so, because I really do understand, like, the premise of the Second Amendment and being able to have the ability to protect yourself. I have no issue with that. But I do have an issue with people having access, everyday people, to machine guns. Like, there's nothing necessary about that, including hunting. Like, I'm sorry.
Literally do better if you're hunting with a machine gun.
And then it's going to be destroyed anyways. So wishes.
There's no argument there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a double-edged sword with this shit because, you know, obviously, whether it's contraception or gun reform, like these are real people's lives it affects. And when you have to kind of like do this, like Chuck Schumer has to politicize an issue to help election outcomes, it's a double-edged sword. But ultimately, like if this means that in November people are mobilized to turn out and vote for a Democratic trifecta, meaning we control the House, the Senate, and the presidency, then there is a reality in which we can codify abortion. We can protect the right to contraception. We can get legitimate gun reform, climate change, voting rights. Like that is a very, very real reality that this election can create. And I think that's lost upon some people, especially given, which is fair because we've had election after election people being told like, this is the election, like existential election. It's exhausting. We get it. But this really is. And it's actually crazy. Like the two very different realities that can come from this election, like Democratic trifecta means literally achieving all of these solutions we've been pushing for so long and repro gun, et cetera. Or this other reality where Donald Trump could be reelected and we could lose everything. So many basic rights. It's fucking scary. So, yeah, I just think it's important to tie it all back to that and that, like, also all these issues are connected and there's people working for all of them, and make sure you try to identify that when you go to vote. But what this episode is also about is a lot of those, like, really basic reforms around guns and especially, like, access to guns and households and making sure that, like, no one's trying to take your guns away, but, like, let's make sure they're, like, safely stored and kids can't have access, etc. So this episode is really great to like just painting the picture of like the truly like basic reforms we're looking for. Like it's nothing crazy, it's nothing drastic, it's common sense.
No, it really is. And side note that's related, that I wonder, like with, you know, like Schumer's like bringing these bills to the floor to vote again for like the sake of like the Republicans are going to vote no, and then they're on the record with like what their opinions are, which I do think is like very important from a like here's the evidence point of view. But I do wonder, and this is something that we grapple with, like with the podcast, with the newsletters, everything, if then seeing this lack of progress, like seeing even more, like again, block, if it actually only frustrates voters more, makes them disengage even more because they're like, okay, see, like
what the fuck?
Like, yeah. Because I like to sometimes I like we're so close to it now. And like when we back in the day, we weren't as close to it. And I think sometimes it can be like hard to zoom out of like, okay, like our friends that aren't as like, they're politically engaged when we push them to be, you know, but they aren't on the regular, are not as tapped in as we are. Like, what did they, when they see that at a glance, like what is it that they're taking away from that? And I know it's different from how we see it as this larger strategic move and this chess piece and that blah, 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 blah coming together. And so when I see that, again, I'm happy things are on the record because there's the proof in the pudding. But at the same time, I'm like, it's almost it's like, yeah. It's like almost like negative reinforcement.
Point. Yeah, it's definitely something to consider and be careful of. I don't think it's a strategy that we should do all the fucking time. It's just going to drive people crazy. But what it does do, and what's important, especially this year with what we're seeing, is like the contrast needs to be painted. Like, and if this is how we have to do it, then hey. Because again, when it's especially such a basic shit like this, like your literal right to condoms, like, And there's a party that's voting no to that. Like, it should be clear. It just hopefully can be clear to people, like, who's working for you and who's not. Or at least maybe not who's even working for you, but, like, who's working against you. Because that is the contrast that's, like, so clear. And then hopefully also we can continue to amplify wins and good governance to go alongside that.
And to, like, cap it off, I just want to remind everyone across every up and down the ballot is like, there is no perfect candidate. There are going to be candidates, again, to Maggie's point of like working against you or working for you, like where it is a better option than the other. You're not working with perfect options and you never will. Like democracy just doesn't work that way. People aren't like that. No perfect person exists. So it's crazy to think that like all of a sudden you're going to build essentially like a robot of a person to represent.
No, yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
There's so no perfect caution. Person. Nobody's perfect, as Hannah Montana once said.
A legend.
What I will say along with that is like, I think people have gotten confused of like where we're at in this timeline of our country. Like when Obama became president, like that moved so many things forward and like created a lot of progress in a lot of ways. But we have to realize like Donald Trump being president took us back so far and made us, it put us in a place where we have a lot of catching up to do, a lot of work to do, because Jesus, it not only his policies, but the movement that he created and like the culture and the things that like became all of a sudden acceptable to be again, aka like racist, etc. Just like we're not where we think we are. People who like want to, you know, go for a third party or whatever. It's like that is a reality we can get to, but we're not there because of literally the same situation, the same type of election we're having right now happened in 2016, where people didn't like the two options. There were third parties that seemed okay. People went for them and Donald Trump got elected. And like it brought us back so far. That's happening again this year. And just like, don't let history repeat itself.
Yeah.
Because
especially the people,
we're not where we want to be. Yeah.
No.
And we need a stepping stone of a candidate, of a president who's going to help us get there, which is Joe Biden.
Yeah. Like if you don't create the bridge, you can't get to the other side. So like,
yeah.
What you gonna do? Just jump into the water, like into the abyss, the fiery like lava? Like it ain't it. So nonetheless, this episode and interview is really about the progress that we can make and some of those things that are really, I think, tangible. Unified in terms of policy. Yeah, policy ideas across the board. So nonetheless. Let you guys get back into this one. This is a great episode. We love Chris.
Share it.
Share it with all your friends, especially those that feel like just so lost in the sauce. I was going to say downtrodden. That sounded real bad.
Down bad, crying in the gym. For all your friends who are down bad, crying in the gym, send them this episode. I was going to say send them this song. Send them this episode and help them see that amidst the darkness, there are solutions that can bring forth the light. Call Taylor Swift. I have the election song from 2024.
She's a poet. She doesn't even know it. That's really...
Yeah.
You know, I started this off with song and Maddie ended it with a poem. And I think that really shows our mental state at this point. So anyways, without further ado, here's the episode. We are so excited to have Chris Brown, who's the president of Brady, on the podcast today. We are beyond excited to get into an unfortunately dark topic, but with so many facts that we need to wrap our minds around. So to get things started, for those that don't know Brady, can you walk us through what the organization does and all that jazz?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for having me. Really appreciate being here. And talking a little bit about what I view as now vocation, being the head of Brady, United Against Gun Violence. It's the oldest, and we'd like to say boldest, gun violence prevention organization in America. It was founded by Jim and Sarah Brady. Jim Brady served as President Ronald Reagan's press secretary. He was shot in the line of duty. And he and Sarah spent the rest of their lives working very hard for the enactment of common sense gun legislation. They passed, after 6 years and seven votes in Congress, the Brady background check system that's been in effect for more than 25 years and stopped more than 4 million sales of guns to prohibited purchasers. They also passed our nation's assault weapons ban. Unfortunately, at the last minute, a provision was added to that ban that caused it to expire after 10 years. We continue to work at Brady for the advancement of laws like an assault weapons ban, the expansion of the Brady Law, extreme risk protection laws, a lot of that I know we'll get into. But we also recognize that gun violence is a public health epidemic. So we focus on working in Congress and the state houses, working in the courts, better enforcing the laws, and changing social norms around guns in this country, and really bringing gun owners into the conversation as part of the change we need to see.
Mm-hmm. Love that. Well, for a little bit of background about you too, can you kind of give us the run through of how you ended up at Brady? Like, what did kind of that career journey look like for you to end up in this position?
Sure, yes. So I graduated from college. I was an English major and therefore unemployed. No, just teasing. English majors are the best, guys.
I agree. Communications is key. And
100%.
Being an English major, perfect.
Served me very well, as it turns out. But I volunteered for a congressional campaign that was written up in Congressional Quarterly as one of the most expensive at that time. This is in 1990s. And for those of you who know that tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions are spent on some congressional races, it was the most expensive in 1990 because just over $1 million was spent. So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
My candidate won. I worked on Capitol Hill for 8 years when Jim and Sarah helped pass the Brady Law. I became a lawyer. I went to law school at night, practiced for 16 years, lived overseas with my family. I have daughters who are 19 and 21. And when we moved back to the United States, I really wanted to help tackle the issue of gun violence because it is an epidemic in this country. And it helps you see it better when you're outside of the United States. And you can understand that no person coming to America for the first time or even the second considers that visit without seriously having concerns that they will get shot in America.
Wow.
And that's to me is not freedom's safest place. It's not consistent with the America I was taught in civics we should live in. And it's not in an America that I can take pride in, quite frankly. So that's why I committed to helping where I can and am very proud to be a part of this storied organization.
Yeah, I actually just saw a video of someone talking about that, how there's travel warnings, warning tourists coming here that there is a potential of being a part of just like this carnage of gun violence in the US. And that's crazy to think about. And especially a perspective that I think most people aren't aware of, given being here, you know, that external point of view is really interesting.
Right. That's right. But that is how the rest of the world sees us. And it's not a surprise because we now lose more children to gun violence than any other cause of death, just for an example. So it's not I don't think it's being unpatriotic to point that out. I think it's the heart of patriotism to want America to be safer and better than it is today.
Mm-hmm. But not agree more. Well, speaking about the future and trying to figure out a way forward, we want to talk about the Brady Plan. Can you give us insight as to what this is and what its design is meant to do?
Yes, thank you. Brady wants to free America from gun violence. Those are five words, but they really say it all, in part because we recognize that America is in the grips of what is a public health epidemic, and we want to liberate ourselves from that. And the way to do that is in three fundamental areas where Brady is engaged and actively leading the movement, the gun violence prevention movement, which is now stronger than ever in this country for change. The first is policy. Of course, Jim and Sarah set national policy, but state policy is very important too. So we're active at the federal level and the state level to shape gun violence prevention policies like expanded Brady background checks, assault weapons bans, extreme risk laws, and others. We also are involved in enforcement of the law. So we can pass these laws like the Brady Law, but unless we are resourced to help the agencies like the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms that regulates gun dealers, or like state police that will investigate how dealers are selling guns in their states, to help them see how to enforce the law, then the law is not going to be nearly as strong or as effective as it should be. So we have teams of experts at Brady who assist agencies and enforcement officials in really ensuring that the laws we pass are implemented in an effective, fair, and non-discriminatory manner. That's very important to us. And the final area is social norm change. Policy has a role, enforcement has a role, but we have more guns than people in America today. And unless we are communicating to gun owners about the dangers of guns that are unsecured in the home, we can't end the epidemic of gun violence. And part of the reason why is we're losing 46,000 people on average right now to gun violence in the year. 65% of those are suicides. If you have a loaded and unsecured gun in the home, you have a significantly increased likelihood that you will experience suicide. So, and family fire is our designated driver, secondhand smoke, public interest campaign directed at gun owners with one simple message. If you want to save lives in your home, if you want to end family fire, you need to safely store that firearm. So all three of those activities, policy, enforcement, and social norm change, are areas Brady leads with cutting edge programs, but also data-driven programs. All of these things that I've explained, we actually collect data on to make sure we're doing the right things, we're holding ourselves accountable, and over time that we feel that we will be saving lives.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I have so many questions about just pretty much every pillar here, all three pillars. And I know we're going to get into depth in order, but I do want to ask one question before we do that. And that is about the social norms and changing that. And I'm curious what the roadblocks you guys find are with gun owners. Like, what is in a conversation with a gun owner about safely securing weapons? Like, what is the feedback or the commentary? Pushback. Yeah, the pushback. Yeah. That's the word I'm looking for.
Great question. Well, in order to launch our campaign, we launched it in 2018, and we have over 3.2 billion views of the campaign now. And every time we launch a new creative for this campaign, we have a hundred nine different pieces of creative collateral. We do focus groups with gun owners and people we call considerers, people who are considering the purchase of a gun. The feedback we've gotten is super interesting, and I'll put it into three buckets. The first is that many gun owners feel judged about the decision to bring a gun into the home. They feel that in our society today, saying that they are gun owners is synonymous in some people's minds with saying they're stupid. And so it's horrific that gun owners feel this way, because ultimately that is a personal decision that you can make. There may be various reasons for it. And so we have to demystify this idea or debunk this idea that choosing to have a gun is a completely irrational act, and that this is pitting gun owners versus non-gun owners. Gun owners want to be part of the solution too. They don't want gun violence to happen. They don't want guns to be in the wrong hands. And so finding a way to bridge that gap and to have conversations about the role of guns without judgment of the decision to have a gun, but in sharing information and sharing conversations of, if you're choosing to have a gun, here is why safe storage is so important. Now, once you get to that point, the other piece of pushback that we sometimes get is, well, if I don't have my gun right at my bedside, or in some cases, we've talked to some people in their living room next to the door, loaded and unsecured, then what will I do if someone breaks into my home? Now, that is a much easier conversation to have with people than it would have been maybe a decade ago, because of the prevalence of gun safes that are biometric that are now at very reasonable price points, where you just put your finger on the safe and it is instantly open. And the reality that we focus on with folks is the opportunity for you to safely store your firearm is one that can not only save your own life, it can save the life of your kids. 8 kids a day are being killed or injured with guns in their own home. And that is the real risk that you're introducing when you bring a gun into your home. So we don't push back on the idea that you may, in fact, want a gun for safety. The point of End Family Fire is anyone who's choosing a gun or a firearm in their home for safety is doing it because they love their family. Part of loving your family is also protecting them from unintentional injury or death with that gun, as well as suicide. Because if you have a loaded and unsecured gun, 5 times more likely that household is to experience a suicide. Once people get those facts, it's amazing the conversations that can happen and the number of people we're finding who go out instantly and buy gun safes. That's exactly what we want to see happen.
No, that's so interesting and definitely a big, big piece of the conversation. I think everyone, when thinking about gun reform, instantly goes to policy, but that like social aspect is so important. And I'm glad you guys are covering that. But we want to get into our I Have a Stupid Question segment. It's a long one. We have a lot of explaining to do as far as different terms and different solutions. So we want to get into that with you and starting with kind of this background checks bucket. It's a yeah. big one. And the first question we have is regarding the Brady Bill, which you've mentioned. And so we kind of want to first get an idea of what is the Brady Bill? Is it still in place? Can you kind of give us that run through?
Sure. So the Brady Bill, as I mentioned, it was passed into law in 1993, went into effect in 1994. Basically, what that does is set up a system that actually was in effect in 1968, in the Gun Control Act of 1968, but it had no enforcement mechanism. So if you go in under the Brady Law, named for Jim and Sarah Brady, the authors, you know, our organization's namesake. If you go in to purchase a gun anywhere in the United States from a federally licensed firearms dealer, that firearms dealer by law is required to run a background check, sometimes called the Brady background check. That background check queries an FBI database for information about whether or not you're a prohibited purchaser. The categories of prohibited purchasers were borrowed in the Brady Law that passed in 1993 from the 1968 Gun Control Act. That's how long these categories have been in effect. So if you're a convicted felon, if you're a convicted domestic abuser, if you have been institutionalized for a certain period of time, usually 72 hours or more, these are different categories that are enshrined in law. Then the FBI will provide a report back almost instantly in virtually every case. Something like 97% of background checks come back within seconds of the query from the gun dealer. And if you are a prohibited purchaser, that gun dealer by law must deny the purchase of that gun to you. They cannot sell it to you. Yes, it's still in place. I would just say to forecast some of your other questions, it was passed more than 25 years ago. I'll age myself by saying, well before this guy waving an iPhone, well before the internet, well before gun shows being big business. Today they are big business. And so the gaps that we have in the law mainly come from internet sales and gun show sales that are not technically covered if they're private sellers. Those sellers are not technically covered by the federal Brady Law. And that's what we want to fix.
Okay, doubling down on that, what really is a gun show? Because we hear this a lot, that there's this loophole. People can go to gun shows and just purchase willy-nilly and go on with their day. But what is the difference really between a gun show and purchasing there and going to, I'm guessing, is a dealer licensed?
Yes, that's the difference. So think about it this way. For every gun dealer in this country, and I have to give a shout out to President Biden for helping to try to refine what it is to be in the business of selling guns such that you're required to get a license, right? And before Biden really tried to specify this, it was a little bit loose in terms of whether you were in the business of selling guns or not. And that looseness allowed basically smaller entities that may have been, frankly, they were supposed to be subject to a license, but they didn't get licenses to sell guns with no background check at all. And how did they do that? Before, in the 90s, there wouldn't have been an opportunity to do that because there were a handful of gun shows across the country. Those are just like big tents. You see them all over Virginia, where I live, many other states where they've proliferated, where you will literally have sometimes hundreds of vendors selling firearms. Now, some of them may be federally licensed, and then they have to do background checks, but they could be four stalls down from an entity that says it's a smaller seller that is not licensed. And so if you were someone who is a prohibited purchaser, which stall would you go to?
Right.
right? And that is the disparity in the law. What we know from the data and the research we've done is because of the internet sales, where there can be sales in the internet in half of states where they haven't closed this loophole, and you could go online and look for a firearm, and some of the advertisements even say, cash only, no questions asked, meaning no background check, and purchase that firearm and pick it up within a very short distance of your home if you're in a state that hasn't enhanced the Brady background check system. So that's how the loophole works. One in five guns sold today is sold through those loopholes, either at a gun show or over the internet. And tragedy ensues all too often because a lot of these people who are exploiting the loopholes are people who should never have guns.
Yeah,
that is.
I mean, I am a little confused though on how gun shows are even allowed, because that's technically like buying them in person. Like, how did that loophole even come to be? Like, if you have to be licensed to sell, but then when did these gun shows pop up? I'm so confused.
You have to be licensed to sell over a certain number, and the statute was unclear. So the way that they would skirt around this is they would say, well, I'm not selling that number, and they're not recording all of them. So some of this is happening in a highly unregulated environment. The entity that's responsible across the country for regulating most of these are the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which has been chronically underfunded, and sometimes state police. So the reason we want a federal Brady law in place that covers gun shows and internet sales is we want one rule consistent across the states for what it means to be a licensed firearm seller. And we don't think it should make any difference whether you're selling at gun shows or you're selling over the internet or you have a brick or mortar store. The only thing that would not be subject to a Brady background check are interfamilial transfers. If you and I are related and I'm passing the gun down to you. Outside of that, we think every gun sale should be subject to a background check, and that would actually provide a universal background check.
Yeah.
Just an idea.
Perfect segue. Yeah,
and maybe, not to kill our segue, but I have like a side question because classic.
Yeah.
And would there be any use for banning, like, okay, hold on, let me back this up. How do I want to phrase this? So you know how if you're going to put on like a state fair, for example, you have to get permission to like rent the federal land or the state land for something or from the town? Could like towns pass ordinances to block land, like public land, for being used for gun shows?
Wow, it's so interesting you ask that question. Of course, like everything else in the firearms world, it becomes endlessly complicated. And I know you have a lot of questions, so let me try to be succinct in my answer. Yes and no. If you live in a state like many states where the legislature has said about firearms regulation, which is unique because they haven't said it about many things, but often, like in Virginia, they say it about firearms regulation, which is, localities have no authority to pass any ordinance to restrict gun sales. You'd be shocked the number of states that say that, and therefore you as a locality would have no ability to do that. If you live in a state where you're allowed to regulate or legislate in that area, yes, you can do that. And in fact, for example, some of our great chapter leaders in California have totally shut down gun shows in their jurisdictions on that basis. But it can be tough, if not impossible, if you live in a state where the legislature has said that you have no authority to act on behalf of your constituents in this area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, more reason why sweeping federal legislation, please. Let's just cut all that work out of the equation. But getting back to our segue, what is a universal background check? You mentioned it. Can you kind of define what that is? I think that's another kind of buzzword that we hear so much.
Yes, exactly. So basically, it's background checks for every gun sale. It is closing the loophole that I described that exists with respect to gun shows and the internet, and ensuring that any person who's actually selling a firearm to a third party must undertake a background check before that sale is completed.
Got it. Okay. I feel like that's like a very good spot for us to just, or just a clear definition. And I think that one gets muddied a lot. I am curious though, in this litany of things, what a waiting period is, because that's another one we hear a ton. Some people have waiting periods, some people don't. Like, what is the application of it? Just curious there.
Yes. Well, some states, before the Brady Law was enacted, the 1968 Gun Control Act did have a waiting period to attempt to, you know, put some time, and sometimes it was 3 days or 5 days between when the sale happened and when the sale was completed. That waiting period exists under the law and was enshrined in the Brady Law. Right now, it's 3 days, where if a background check has not come back, right? 97%, as I said, are instantaneous, meaning they come back and the dealer knows whether someone's a prohibited purchaser right away. But a fraction of those background checks don't come back right away. So what is a dealer to do? Well, they can't sell the gun in that instance. They need to wait until the background check comes back. Right now, under law, that waiting period is 72 hours. However, under federal law, until recently, if the background check still had not come back, the sale would proceed anyway. It's called the default proceed rule. Some states have changed that, like California has a 10-day waiting period, because they know that basically 100% of all background checks will come back in that time period. We at Brady advocate for that and have advocated for extending the waiting period, because all of the data shows us that if a background check is taking longer than a few seconds to come back, often there is a real issue with that record, such that the person, the FBI needs more time to research. And we, again, have seen the real problem with shorter waiting periods in case like the Charleston shooting at the church, where that individual who obtained that weapon and shot parishioners and the reverend there in cold blood, who was a white supremacist, after praying with them, and it was just horrific, obtained his weapon despite the fact that the background check hadn't come back after 3 days. That's horrific, and we need to fix that.
100%. One thing that I have always had questions around with background checks, and just like this being a major solution, obviously, that needs to be put forth, like, I've always been curious, because behind a lot of the pushback on solutions, it's kind of like big gun manufacturers and gun lobbyists and such. I'm curious, like, what putting background checks in place does to gun sales that like make them push back on it, if that makes sense. Like, I'm just curious, if it does it slash it so much? Like, it just kind of seems crazy that there would be pushback on something like this.
It is crazy. It's deeply upsetting. And no, I mean, almost every gun dealer that I ever interact with is more than happy to engage in background checks. The way to think about it is this way. The National Rifle Association and the other industry group called the National Shooting Sports Foundation, or NSSF, they are basically representing the industry. And if you're in an industry and you're just say, let's say you're selling widgets, not something capable of taking another person's life, what you want as a strategy is as many barriers to transactions to be removed as possible. And so the NRA really looked at background checks as a barrier to the transaction, because their entire motive is to sell as many guns as possible to as many people as quickly as possible. That's why even during COVID, they got President Trump at the time to pass a regulation declaring the sale of guns a national emergency, like getting vaccinated, because they were terrified that gun sales would slump. During the pandemic, gun sales increased by 64%. So that's, For all of your listeners, the way to think about it is that way. It explains everything. And it may get people upset that that's the explanation, but that truly is the explanation. They fought Jim and Sarah every step of the way, I'm pointing to something I have in my office with Sarah Brady saying, help me fight the National Rifle Association, because they were trying to quash the background check system that has now stopped more than 4 million sales of guns. So we've been fighting them and their campaign to distort the reality of what we do significantly, because this isn't anti-gun. This is anti-gun violence.
Right,
right.
Oh, I have so many like questions on this whole side of things too, which how do you go after the NRA, these big, you know, players? Are there policy solutions that can be done in that way? Regulations, like what does that look like? Because obviously all of these solutions, safe storage, background checks are incredible. We need them. But is there some way to kind of, I don't know, infiltrate this big industry and regulate them in a way that can actually solve this even more broadly?
It's a great question. When I say Brady's strategy is policy, really what we're trying to do is ensure better regulation of the industry. Enforcement is enforcement of the law in a meaningful way across the board. One of the biggest barriers to us doing that effectively against the industry is what's called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, or PLACA, big mouthful, for a bill that Congress passed that purports to give absolute immunity to the gun industry from any lawsuit at all against them. That is the biggest barrier we currently face. Congress passed that law in response to Brady's litigation representing victims of gun violence. We fight tooth and nail. You will hear President Biden say again and again and again, we need to repeal PLACA. And Brady litigates in the courts and has poked a lot of holes in PLACA. But really, that's one of the most important things. The other we can't do directly as much, but it's very important and it's having a lot of success, because as much as we have weakened the NRA, their own avarice has weakened them more than anything else. And the reality that they're not representing the interests of everyday gun owners who strongly support these policies in poll after poll. The reality is that the New York Attorney General, Tish James, has done more to really open the curtain, throw sunshine and disinfectant on top of the NRA. And that's been very important. They're a nonprofit. They are not paying taxes, okay? Yes. And it's fine if they were being true to their foundations, which is about hunter safety and things like safe storage. That was the essence of why they were founded. They've strayed a long way from that. So Tish James, the attorney general, filed a 190-page complaint and is seeking to remove the nonprofit status of the NRA. The NRA is spending, as far as I know, about $1 to $2 million a month defending itself. They tried to declare bankruptcy to get that lawsuit thrown out. They were unsuccessful in doing that. The bankruptcy court threw out their bankruptcy filing. And together, these various actions, I think, along with their failure to ever say anything other than the way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, right? And more guns make us safer. The reality of America being the only industrialized country where kids are dying of gun violence as the number one killer, I think belies all of that. So I think the NRA is actually very much on the defensive, but I'd love to see it change from within, because I think the biggest threat to civilized, responsible gun ownership exists with the current leadership of the National Rifle Association.
Yeah. Oh, man. So many thoughts.
Ooh,
but it's good to know, too, that like all of that is happening. Those lawsuits, I feel like some of that isn't honestly covered much in the news and everything. And so to know that there are people poking holes in kind of like the bigger monster that is the NRA, along with, you know, implementing some of these solutions that we're talking about today, is good to know, because I feel like that's something Sam and I always talk about, like mass tragedy after mass tragedy, like, how do we kind of cut through some of this bullshit and like just get to the root of the problem? Yeah. And it's good to know that there are people and those lawyers out there doing that work, because
that's something I always wonder about.
Absolutely. It makes me feel great too. So there are a lot of different moving pieces and a lot of people of goodwill and very important public servants making making a difference here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking of moving parts, we do want to talk about safe storage. Yes. And you guys have a campaign called the End Family Fire Campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. I hearken to this in response to your introductory question about what Brady focuses on, which is Congress, courts, communities, or policy enforcement, social norm change. End Family Fire is really in the social norm change bucket. And what it is our version of designated driver or secondhand smoke, which were just ad campaigns. I mean, everyone knows those terms now, but they were just invented by ad agencies, something just remarkable to think about. But they changed all of our behavior, not just me, who was born after those terms were invented, but my daughters and their daughters and so on. And so it's incredible to think about the power of advertising to change behavior. And that's really what this is all about. This is a campaign that is putting a name, Family Fire, to the death or injury of a loved one with an unsecured firearm in the home. We have creative that's all over the country, that's TV ads, that's billboards, that's radio, that's print, that's digital, that is directed to gun-owning households, just reminding them of why safe storage can combat family fire. And that is suicide. It is the 8 kids a day who are killed or injured with guns in the home. And it's the 75% of school shooters who get their guns from a home where that firearm is unsecured. And that's why we know it's so important, because if everyone engaged in safe storage in this country who had a firearm tomorrow, we would cut gun deaths in half overnight.
Wow. That's crazy. Well, can you kind of paint the picture so people know, like, what does safe storage even look like? What does storage like typically look like too? And now, you know, there's new technology as well. Can you kind of paint that picture of how things have changed in the safe storage realm?
Yes, absolutely. So safe storage means having your firearm, whether that's a long gun, a handgun, or something in between, unloaded, locked in a safe of some kind. There are all kinds of safes, combination safes, safes that are biometric, safes with a lock, a lot of different kinds of technology out there, and a proliferation of technology now using biometrics, which make it super easy to open that safe, no issue with it, and ammunition separate and separately stored and separately locked. Now, all of that is very important because the campaign is intended to greatly reduce gun death and injury from the kinds of causes that come from inadequate storage. And that is about 26,000 people a year who are completing a suicide with a loaded unsecured firearm in the home. That means the 8 kids a day who are unintentionally injured or killed. And that means the 75% of school shooters. So we have to, as part of this, really embed information, which you can find at endfamilyfire.org, about the kinds of safes that are out there, which are a dizzying array, how you can store them, where you might keep the safes. So really, this is providing as much information as we can to gun owners and people considering buying a firearm about why and how safe storage can be used, not to limit your ability to have a gun, but to store it safely so that no one within your home or who's visiting is harmed.
Totally. I have another question. Why does the NRA and any other lobbying group push against safe storage? Because to me, like, I understand the background checks in terms of the context of a business. You want to get, like you said, as many guns sold as quickly as possible, and you want to keep sort of that hamster wheel going. But I don't see how having safe storage would prevent any sales. And I also don't see how that couldn't be lucrative for them as well to sell like these storage containers.
New product line.
Right. And it's like, or like, and you could do all the different marketing, like get your free, like, safe storage blocker when you buy XYZ. Like,
like any other product. And so I just don't really understand that. Is there anything that you've seen or heard or just have like an insight on as to that pushback?
I don't know. I've asked to meet with Wayne LaPierre, who ironically, you know, he does head up the National Rifle Association and has for more than two decades. He's 15 minutes away down the street and he doesn't want to sit down with me. I have all the same thoughts you do. I think the way to understand it is like so much else that's very hard to understand unless you think about this as simply and completely profit motive that is underwritten by selling firearms as a zero risk proposition. We know from Tish James's lawsuit against the NRA and the discovery that's been undertaken that a huge portion of their budget was spent on a marketing company called Ackerman McQueen that actually LaPierre had very close personal ties to. Not a surprise. That's the story of his life. Mm-hmm. And there were kickbacks happening there is what Tish James alleges. And there's a lot of evidence to support the idea that that's true. But what LaPierre asked Ackerman McQueen to do to sell more guns was to sell the idea that more guns make us safer. That's a lie. If that were true, we'd be the safest country in the world,
right?
Because we have more guns than people. And nothing stops a good guy like a gun with a bad guy with a gun. Now, nothing stops a bad guy with a gun like a good guy with a gun. Sorry. If you are in the business of selling that kind of, frankly, dystopian universe, talking about safe storage belies that firearms are actually potentially dangerous. And so I think it's that it hurts. They can't square how to continue marketing more guns in everyone's hands anywhere with safe storage. And they won't, even though it would save lives, even though their members would so benefit from them talking about this in a robust way. They don't want to. They want to double, they don't want to move back from the really basically dystopian universe that they've doubled down on to sell as many firearms as they possibly can.
That makes a load of sense, though. The inability to message those things together. Okay.
Yeah.
See, now I'm seeing the English major scenario and the communication, all those things coming together. But that makes a load of sense. Pun not intended. But we do want to also talk about suicide and guns. And I know.
Yeah.
It's been integrated into our conversation, but we're seeing a huge increase of suicides with guns. We've seen the risk of it as well. It goes up 300% for having a gun at home. Why is that? And what is so connected with suicide and guns in particular?
Yeah. It's a really hard thing, right? Especially post-COVID, you know, typically suicides have always been a large component of gun death and injury in this country. It's typically been white men between the ages of 45 and 65. When I say typically, like 80% or so of those completing a suicide up until recently had been in sort of that demographic. It's shifting a lot. And part of that is we have more guns in people's homes post-COVID. I told you about the 64% increase. So we're seeing increases in teens, increases in minority populations that heretofore had not been attempting suicide with a firearm. It's alarming. It's really alarming to see it. And the reason why it is such a problem is because for the most part, if you talk, and I'm not an expert by any means on suicide, but we work with many, many, many organizations who are, and the person who leads our End Family Fire program comes to us from that space. And the reality is that most people who attempt suicide do so with very little planning leading up to it. It's typically a very short period of time. They might think about it episodically. They might have ideation, but they don't act on it and move forward with it with a whole lot, typically, some outliers here, with careful, thought out plans. And so the presence of a loaded firearm that is easy to access can mean all the difference between a suicide attempt and completion of a suicide. What do I mean by that? If you attempt suicide with a firearm, 90% of the time you will complete it. 9 out of 10 times, the person who is attempting suicide with a firearm will die. That's compared to all other methods and means of suicide, where the completion rate is 3%, 3% or less. And the additional research that we've done is if you attempt suicide and survive, very few people who attempt with firearms do survive for the reasons I've said, but if you attempt suicide and you survive, for the most part, 90% of the time, you will go on to die from natural consequences, not because you attempted suicide again. So this campaign is really focused on debunking two myths. One is that if someone who's intent on completing a suicide will do so, it just doesn't matter. Means don't matter. They do. And that's why we have a record number of people who are dying from suicide in this country, dying with a firearm. The second is that barriers to access don't matter. They do. They matter hugely. The best evidence we have is that safe storage, if you're choosing to keep a firearm in your home, safe storage is the number one best way. And that means locked, unloaded ammunition separate, because everything that you have to do as an individual to put those things together is reminding you, wait a minute, what am I doing? Putting space and time between those acts can be life-saving. And that's why this campaign is so important, given the suicide rate that we're seeing across this country.
Right. No, that's such an important picture to paint. I'm also curious if there are any other solutions, gun reform-wise, that help with the suicide side of things.
Yes. Yes. One of the biggest, the other thing I have to say is, obviously, if you are at risk, if you have someone at risk in your home, the safest type of storage is remote storage. Remove the risk altogether. That's why within the military, there's this concept of the buddy hold, meaning you have a buddy, you provide them a firearm when you are designating yourself at risk, because we also have an epidemic of suicide among military veterans, about 20 a day who are ending their lives predominantly with guns. So we're trying to move forward with policy that allows those kinds of actions to be easier, more access to remote storage and these kinds of things, so that you don't have to jump through a whole lot of hoops to try and reduce risk if you're at risk or someone in your household is. The other thing is extreme risk protection laws. Those can be incredibly helpful. Those are the laws that allow the removal of a firearm from someone who is at risk, subject to an ex parte hearing. So you have to provide some kind of information that the person has said, I'm at risk to myself or I'm at risk to others. About 19 states now, or exactly 19 states, have passed those laws. Connecticut has the oldest standing one. They passed one after Sandy Hook. Yale did a study, or Duke did a study, I can't remember which institution, on that law. And it found a big correlation between effective implementation of that extreme risk law and reduction in suicide risk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really, really important. And I want to say that probably also means reduction in mass shooting risk, because a lot of the evidence that's coming out about those who've actually looked at mass shooters note that very frequently what they are seeking is suicide by cop. They're just taking many other people down. It's horrific with them. And so finding a way to get mental health treatment and others to those who are subject to extreme risk protection laws is a big priority for Brady.
Yeah. Wait, question on severe risk. How does that work? How does one be on the severe risk list?
Right. So every state is different. It's a creature of state law, these extreme risk protection laws, but more or less there's just a little variant. So in Connecticut, I think it's, you know, police, family members, maybe educators that could seek an extreme risk protection law. And the way you do it is you see, let's just give a hypothetical. Someone has said, I feel I'm very upset with my teacher and I'm going to commit gun violence at my school, and has words to that effect that they've said, it's in writing. You would be able to get an expedited court hearing with that kind of information, and law enforcement would remove firearms from that individual for a period, in most states, of 30 days, although often those orders can be extended. During the interim of the extreme risk protection order, because the court issues the order, in some states, and Connecticut is best in class in this, individuals subject to the order will be connected with state-funded mental health treatment for whatever issues may be happening or may not be, right? Those things have to be assessed. The Bipartisan Safer Communities Act that passed Congress, that Joe Biden signed into law last year, provides unprecedented funding for states across this country to train all of those on the front lines of seeing risk related to individuals on how to seek an extreme risk protection law, and a lot more funding for mental health treatment to encourage states to make those kinds of connections that Connecticut has, that when Connecticut's law was studied indicated, yeah, we've seen a reduction in harm, especially from suicide as a result of this law.
Interesting. Especially, I feel like when that law passed, so many of us were like, yay, like progress, but also felt like it was missing a lot, obviously, an assault weapons ban, I think, is really at the top of all of our minds. So it's been really, I don't even know what the right word is. I don't want to say lackluster, but because it's obviously doing something and very important work. But it was one of those things where it's like, it's hard to really visualize or understand the gravity of what it could do. And I think even on the daily, like, I still really grapple with that, of trying to understand, like, what does that actually mean in application? And I think sometimes, like, when we have funding models for things, obviously it's important. We have to fund these resources, otherwise they're useless. But seeing funding go towards something and then seeing mass shootings every day, and you're like, where does this bridge finally connect? I think can be, I know it's frustrating for myself, but I think it's one of those things that gets really tricky. And I think, too, we're always talking about, okay, Biden 2024, what's the messaging going to be and all of that? And trying to message around that in particular is really tricky when, for example, you're still seeing all these mass shootings. So,
yeah. That's why we have to think about gun violence as having different root causes. What's driving homicide is different from what's driving suicide, is different often from what's driving mass shootings. And even though assault weapons, Brady has, since I joined, been very active and vocal on wanting an assault weapons ban. Jim and Sarah are the reason we had one to begin with, a federal one from 1994 to 2004. And it saved a lot of lives, reduced the use of those sorts of weapons and mass shootings, shockingly, right? Of course it did, significantly. But I will say, mass shootings represent 2-3% of all gun deaths. I hate that so many of my friends I've made in this movement, because they lost their children in mass shootings. So I'm the first to say, yes, let's do that. But I will say, it's not enough. And I don't want to minimize how important I, as the head of Brady, think getting the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act through was. And it provided a lot of different things that are super important that I'd love to spend an entire podcast talking about, because I don't think that people really understand the game changer that that was. And I understand why, because it's hard to live in a society where we can get something like that through and we can't probably get an assault weapons ban through. It makes no sense. It's a whole separate conversation, but I don't want it to minimize how important and how many lives I think can be saved with what we did pass. It's one piece of it. One piece.
Yeah, right. Totally. Well, is there anything, like, solutions wise that you think that we maybe didn't talk about today that people can, like, have their eye on as far as pieces of hope, I guess, on this issue? I think this is an issue that is very disheartening for so many. It doesn't feel like there's much movement. I feel like this conversation has made me see that there's so much movement, especially, again, because obviously these solutions that we've talked about are kind of on the individuals a lot, on, like, the gun owners. But there's this kind of bigger monster at the top that, like, needs to be tackled. And the reason we can't get legislation through Congress or whatever is because of that the NRA that's controlling then, you know, blocking that legislation. So knowing that there's people chipping away at that is amazing. But just curious if there's anything that, you know, people can look to as far as more solutions that we haven't like fully talked about today that you think need to be highlighted.
Well, I just say that the most important thing for your listeners to do is get informed and get engaged, because there are things that can be done. What I always like to talk about is think about your sphere of influence and your sphere of control. I have conversations with my daughters and my 80 plus year old mother about this all the time, because if you just watch the news all day, it's easy to get super disheartened about the state of our world and about your ability to fix anything. But I assure you, on our cause, there are a lot of ways to get involved. First, go to bradyunited.org. We have chapters. We have a youth-led initiative team enough. These guys are rock stars and are just every day growing the number and really making a difference, talking to legislators, getting involved in schools, getting involved civically, locally in communities around this issue. We need help with state legislatures, even with local legislatures, where we're making a lot of progress, but we want to make even more. Mm-hmm. If you're in a state that feels hostile to taking that kind of action, And Family Fire is for you, because at the end of the day, being able to talk to one another in our community, in our neighborhoods, at our schools, at our civic associations, with police departments around this campaign, and we have whole toolkits on our website to be able to do that. And you'll find a community really ready, willing, and able to meet you where you are. In other words, some people are really comfortable getting involved in the political side, and some people want nothing to do with that. I assure you, there's something for everyone, though, to do to make a difference. And I would just say it is on all of us. Unfortunately, I don't want to end on a negative note, but I just read a study by a very reputable organization that 3 years from now, every American will be directly or indirectly impacted by gun violence. They will either be a victim or they will know someone who is. That's the trajectory we're on. Every single person in America has a role in fixing that, and indeed demanding that for the kind of world we all want to live in, because we know we can't live this way, can't go on and on and on. It just won't be a place any of us want to live in. So all of us, especially younger folks, can really make a difference here and hold each other accountable for the change we want.
Absolutely. Well, for closing notes, where can people find out more information about Brady, social, plug all the things, tell us all the deets.
Very good. Well, I have to, of course, because I don't always look at my own social. I'm just checking there very quickly to find out, to make sure I get my own handle right. This is kind of an embarrassing admission against interest. But if you want to see what I'm saying about gun violence, go to at Chris, K-R-I-S-B underscore Brown. And of course, go to at Brady Buzz to find out more information for what Brady is saying every day about the issue. Go to our website. It's full of incredible information about all of the different things that we're doing at the local, state, and federal level, in the courts, within Family Fire, etc. That's bradyunited.org. You can also find us on Insta. And yeah, I think I've covered it.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And yeah, this is such an amazing conversation. We really look forward to all of our listeners tuning in and having you back on, because like we noticed in this interview, there are a lot of rabbit holes that require, yes, you know, a lot of exploring. So we look forward to, of course, continuing the conversation at a later date.
Me too. Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. I really appreciate what you guys are doing and your approach to it.
Thank you.
Hey guys, popping in with a reminder to sign up for the GovHub newsletter. This weekly pop of politics is designed to share action items, resources, and quick links to civic engagement tools and topics directly to your inbox. Save it, share it, and sign up for a pinch of productive politics today by going to girlonthegov.com or visiting this episode's description.